Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for April 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. Ag and Environment, Carbon Pipeline. Dickinson County Leaders Unanimously Approve Pipeline Ordinance. By Jared Strong, April 16th, 2024. Supervisors of Dickinson County voted unanimously Tuesday to implement new restrictions on the placement of carbon dioxide pipelines to create larger buffers between them and people and animals. Quote, "We've tried to balance both sides," said Bill Leopold, chairperson of the county's five-member board of supervisors. "I think this ordinance does it." By approving the ordinance and waiving two other votes to make it effective immediately, the county faces the threat of litigation from Summit Carbon Solutions, a company that is on the cusp of potentially receiving approval for its project from Iowa regulators. Summit seeks to build a five-state pipeline system to transport captured carbon dioxide from ethanol plants to North Dakota for underground storage. It has sued five other Iowa counties that have enacted similar ordinances. Dickinson's ordinance includes less restrictive separation distances, which county leaders have hoped will preclude them from litigation. Notably, they reduced the distance from cities from 2 miles to 1,600 feet, or by about 85%. There is a similar setback requirement for homes. The ordinance also requires the pipeline to be at least a half mile from schools, nursing homes, medical facilities, and public parks, and 1,000 feet from livestock operations. However, the reduced distances will have the potential to affect Summit's planned route through the county that is currently being weighed by the Iowa Utilities Board. A federal judge issued permanent injunctions in December to bar Shelby and Story counties from enforcing their pipeline ordinances. The ruling said the IUB has authority over pipeline routes, and the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration governs their safety. Quote, "The court sees setbacks as safety standards, which fall under the exclusive authority of the federal agencies, not local ordinances," Scott O'Connick, a Summit project manager, told the Dickinson supervisors before their vote. O'Connick said, despite the adjustments to the Dickinson ordinance, it is still very similar to those adopted by Shelby and Story. Appeals of the injunctions for those ordinances are pending. A Summit spokesperson did not immediately respond to request a comment about the Dickinson ordinance. The county ordinances stem largely from residents' concerns about pipeline safety. A catastrophic pipeline breach can create a plume of carbon dioxide that hugs the ground and can travel long distances, potentially asphyxiating people and animals. Quote, "The Board of Supervisors is duty-bound to protect the health and safety of the citizens of Dickinson County," Bonnie Ewalt of Milford said during the supervisors' meeting. "So I urge you to pass this ordinance in spite of Summit's stated intent to sue the county. This is simply evidence of the way Summit bullies its way through." Ewalt was among a handful of residents who spoke in favor of the ordinance, and none spoke against it. Vicki Beck of Spirit Lake said she lives near enough to Summit's proposed route to be potentially affected by a pipeline break, but not sufficiently close to take part in its permit proceedings as an affected landowner. Quote, "As far as Summit is concerned, I have no say," Beck said, "but I live less than 1,600 feet from their pipeline, so I should have a say, and this ordinance is doing that." Summit has repeatedly said its carbon dioxide pipeline system will be the safest that has been constructed to date. In recent months, it has made new agreements to more than double the number of ethanol producers, for a total of 30, that might connect to the system in Iowa. Quote, "Safety of the landowners, communities, and our workers is ingrained in our corporate values and reflected in all we do," O'Connick said. "Protecting local communities and the landscape is our top priority." Summit's project is expected to cost more than $8 billion. The company and ethanol producers would benefit from generous federal tax credits that reward companies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Ethanol plants would further be able to sell their fuels in low-carbon markets. Education, healthcare. Iowa pharmacy students work with drug donation nonprofit to help patients in need. By Brooklyn Dracy, April 15, 2024. It was business as usual for the SafeNetRx staff working in a recent Saturday morning, sifting through boxes and totes of medication packets, inhalers, and medical supplies donated by long-term care centers and clinics. They checked the integrity of the packaging, verified the dosage and expiration, removed any identifying information, and filed it away to eventually be sent to a patient in need. For the three University of Iowa pharmacy students volunteering at the nonprofit for the day, the act of making medicines that would have otherwise been thrown out available for use by those who need it but can't afford it showed them how they can help their patients now and in the future. Quote, I think it kind of is an eye-opener and sort of makes you think more about underserved populations and what goes into helping them, UI student and pharmacy technician Elise Weichert said. SafeNetRx is a Grimes-based nonprofit that takes drug donations from across the country and provides them to pharmacies and clinics in Iowa for patients at or below 200% of the federal poverty line. Staff and volunteers at the organization check to ensure any medications that will be sent out are properly labeled and packaged, and any unusable drugs are safely disposed of. According to SafeNetRx, more than $121 million worth of medications have been donated, and around 141,000 underserved patients have received medication through the nonprofit. SafeNetRx CEO John Rossman said the nonprofit relies heavily on volunteers to help input the medications and through partnerships with universities like the UI and Drake University. Students will come in for a day or longer to help out. It's critical to include students in this work, he said, because it both teaches them that SafeNetRx is here for if their patients need it and shows them that if they can't access the nonprofit, they can maybe help start one up somewhere else. Quote, we have so many students that have either done a rotation here or they might have worked here. They came through an event with Drake or the University of Iowa, and years later, they will contact us and say, so quote, hey, can you help us with this, Rossman said. So it does have a very powerful impact. Drake University pharmacy student Elizabeth Mensing has seen the impact she and others have made on the organization's work spread into the community firsthand. At the community pharmacy she works at when she's not interning at the nonprofit, Mensing said a patient was showing her medication he received for free through SafeNetRx, and it was one she had processed herself. Quote, I love the idea of actually making an impact, Mensing said. I also work at a community pharmacy here in town. It doesn't feel as impactful as what I do here. Each of the UI students volunteering at SafeNetRx works in community pharmacies as well, and know just how high the cost of some medications are. University of Iowa student Gabrielle Marty said this issue was one of the reasons she decided to pursue pharmacy in order to help. None of them, however, had heard of the nonprofit or knew that resources like it were available. Now that they know about it, the students plan to go back to the UI and tell others in order to spread the word. They agreed that SafeNetRx is one solution to helping people who can't afford it receive their meds, but it won't be able to really solve the problem of high drug costs, and it needs more support to expand and reach more people. Quote, all these meds could be so useful, but they don't have the manpower to be able to keep up with the demand for it, UI pharmacy student Caitlin Noering said. Rossman said he would like to expand the nonprofit to other states for providing medication, but with no federal standards for drug donations, the 41 states with enabling legislation to allow the creation of organizations like SafeNetRx each have different requirements. Right now, the focus is on creating partnerships with people in Nebraska, Vermont, and Illinois in the hopes of eventually creating a national drug donation system. SafeNetRx is one of the organizations University of Iowa Healthcare partners with to help lower barriers to medication for its patient. Wenda Ostrom, a UI healthcare pharmacist, financial counselor, and UI graduate, said the healthcare system utilizes the nonprofit's drug repository for patients who need a short-term supply of medication until their insurance kicks in or they get funds to pay for them. Ostrom and her team of five pharmacists and six social workers are available to UI healthcare patients who have expressed concerns about being able to afford their medicine. The team will work with the patient to find resources to lower or eliminate the cost of their medication, from grants to discounts to donated drugs like those from SafeNetRx. In the 20 years since the UIHC Medication Assistance Center was created and Ostrom came into her position, the number of patients utilizing the service has increased slightly year over year, while the total amount saved has risen drastically. Ostrom said a decade ago, the center saved patients just under $8 million in one fiscal year. But in the 2022-23 fiscal year, it saved more than $69 million. This is mostly due to increasing costs of medication, Ostrom said. But as prices have gone up, more resources have become available to try and combat them. The most rewarding part of our job is helping patients access the medicine they need without having to mortgage their house or go without food and other necessities. One of the most frustrating things, however, is knowing that some patients decide to not fill prescriptions due to cost without trying to get help. Ostrom said one of the things she hates to see is patients assuming that they won't be able to take the medication they need after seeing its price. With the organization and funds targeting this very issue, those who need help affording their meds have avenues to receiving treatment that will help them become and remain healthy. Quote, "If you get something prescribed and you can't afford it, just don't automatically assume that you're never going to be able to take that medication," Ostrom said. "Reach out to somebody, reach back out to your provider, talk to your pharmacist, and hopefully somebody will work with you to use one of these resources to lower your costs." Healthcare. Iowa nursing homes staffing levels are among the nation's worst. Iowa ranks sixth in the nation for staffing level violations. By Clark Kaufman, April 16, 2024. Last October, state inspectors visited Des Moines' Fluor Heights Center for Wellness and Rehabilitation to investigate a backlog of 14 complaints alleging substandard care. While one inspector watched, a male resident of the home called out from his bed, quote, "Help me," end quote. A worker reportedly turned off the man's call light and left, telling the man she was busy. Quote, "I'm a human being. I need help," the man told the inspector. The man switched his call light back on, and after 15 minutes, another worker allegedly came in, asked what he needed, switched off the light, and left. Later the same morning, the man was parked in his wheelchair outside his room with the call light out of reach. At the man's request, the inspector switched on the light. A half hour later, an aide allegedly went into the man's room, turned off the light, and left. In the report, the inspectors noted there had been no directive nursing on the Fluor Heights payroll for 3 months, and there weren't enough workers on hand to get residents out of bed, serve meals, or assist those who needed help eating. Residents complained of waiting more than 2 hours for their call lights to be answered. A registered nurse who worked for the home told inspectors the staffing levels were, quote, "terrible," end quote. At times, the inspectors reported the home had just four nurse aides on duty to care for 81 residents. Iowa violations far above the national average. Fluor Heights has Iowa's worst record of compliance with a federal requirement that nursing homes maintain, quote, "sufficient," end quote, staffing levels to care for residents. Over a 9-month period between May 2023 and February 2024, the home was cited but never fined 5 times for insufficient staff, more than any other facility in the state. According to data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, 14% of Iowa's 422 nursing facilities were cited for insufficient staffing in fiscal year 2023. That's more than double the national average, which was 5.9%. Only five other states, Hawaii, Michigan, Montana, New Mexico, and Oregon, had a worse record of compliance with the sufficient staffing requirement. Iowa's neighboring states of Nebraska, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Missouri had no more than 2% to 6.8% of their facilities cited for insufficient staffing in 2023. Nationally, insufficient staffing has long been recognized as the single biggest contributor to poor quality care in nursing homes. Over the past year, the Biden administration has called for the approval of a new rule that would establish, for the first time, specific minimum staffing levels for care facilities that collect taxpayer money through Medicare or Medicaid. That proposal has faced stiff opposition from industry lobbyists and many state and federal Republicans, including Governor Kim Reynolds. Last November, Reynolds and 14 other Republican governors sent Biden a letter saying the nursing home industry was facing a workforce crisis, particularly in rural areas. The governors predicted that minimum staffing levels would, quote, "force over 80% of facilities nationwide to hire more staff," end quote, and result in many of them closing. Proposed rule criticized as too weak. The proposed rule has also faced pushback from advocates for seniors who say the administration, to appease the industry, has watered down the proposal to such an extent it would have little impact. The Center for Medicare Advocacy, for example, has noted that it calls for facilities to provide about a half hour of care each day per resident by a registered nurse and another 2.5 hours a day by a nurse aide. That's a lower level of staffing than what the federal government itself said was necessary in 2001. In addition, the 3-hour care requirements is lower than the average staffing level of 3.76 hours that U.S. nursing facilities currently provide, and which the Center for Medicare Advocacy calls, quote, grossly inadequate. The rule also provides exemptions for facilities that claim they're unable to meet the 3-hour standard, and it allows for phased-in implementation over several years at rural facilities. Still, conservatives in Congress are opposed to the new rule, saying it would drive facilities into bankruptcy. Last month, the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee approved a bill, H.R. 7513, called the, quote, Protecting America's Seniors Access to Care Act, that prohibits the Secretary of Health and Human Services from promulgating any nursing home staffing standards either now or in the future. The committee approved the measure on a largely party-line vote of 26-17, with Iowa's Representative Randy Feenstra joining other Republicans who backed the bill. Quote, Every healthcare provider in my district, I have 36 counties, tells me how difficult it is to find nursing staff, Feenstra said at the time. This staffing rule would be absolutely devastating to the sector that is already struggling to find staff to provide the highest level of care possible. Studies, profits are being concealed. Industry officials don't dispute that additional staff would improve care, but argue that the cost of an expanded workforce, assuming the necessary workers could be found, would be prohibitive. For example, the lobbying organization Leading Age Iowa, which represents many Iowa care facilities, says the Biden administration's proposed rule would cost its members $5.39 million per year. Iowa nursing homes, the organization says, are already operating on a negative 5% operating margin and aren't making any money. Others disagree with the industry's claims of poverty. A new study by researchers at UCLA and Lehigh University reports that nursing homes have engaged in a widespread form of financial maneuvering called, quote, tunneling, end quote, to appear less profitable to regulators. The process involves care facilities paying inflated prices for goods and services that are supplied by commonly owned companies. The study's authors reported, quote, evidence of widespread tunneling, end quote, through inflated rent and management fees doled out to affiliates. Quote, extrapolating these markups to all firms' related party transactions, our estimates suggest that in 2019, 63% of nursing home profits were hidden and tunneled to related parties through inflated transfer prices, the report states. Separately, the Long-Term Care Community Coalition published a report in December that was based on its own analysis of the detailed cost reports the care facilities themselves provide the federal government. The coalition concluded that while the industry reports profit margins of less than 1%, a more realistic figure that takes into account certain expenses and depreciation is 8.84%. Quote, too many seniors and families accept substandard care and inhumane conditions because their nursing home tells them that they cannot afford to hire more staff, said Richard Mollett, executive director of the coalition and co-author of the study. This study provides important evidence showing that nursing homes get plenty of money. They are just not being held accountable for using it appropriately. Violations continue to be cited. If the new rule is not approved, the current standard that imposes a vague and relatively hard to enforce standard of, quote, sufficient, end quote, staffing will remain in place. In December, a few months after the Fluor Heights nurse complained of, quote, terrible, end quote, staffing levels, the state inspectors returned to the facility to investigate 6 additional complaints, and they again cited the home for having insufficient staff. In this instance, the inspector said, the lack of staff had contributed to an assault when a resident of the home attacked a female resident in the dementia unit. According to the inspectors, the woman had been calling for help during the attack, but there was no nurse in the unit, and 2 aides who were on duty were inside the nurse's station and couldn't hear the screams for help. The victim sustained a serious injury that resulted in a trip to the hospital and 6 staples in her head to close the laceration, according to the inspectors. In January, the state inspectors were back at Fluor Heights to investigate more complaints. Again, they cited the home for insufficient staffing. Inspectors noted that some of the residents had, quote, dull and greasy, end quote, hair, with workers explaining there wasn't enough staff to provide baths and showers. Some residents had gone 3 weeks without being bathed, inspectors reported. A few weeks later, in February, inspectors returned to Fluor Heights, this time in response to 4 complaints. Again, the facility was cited for insufficient staff, with residents complaining they had to wait up to a few hours for call lights to be answered. The shortage of staff also resulted in meals and medications being delayed, workers told inspectors. At the close of the inspection, the home's administrator said the facility, which is a for-profit venture owned by Kevin Babb and Dr. Robert Connor, was making plans to hire more staff. The facility, however, already had a 3-star rating for staffing levels on CMS's 5-star scale. In fact, when LPN care is combined with care delivery by RNs, Floor Heights staffing levels greatly exceed the nursing care standards that the Biden administration's proposed new rule would impose. Education, government, and politics. Iowa Senate approves bill adding social studies civics requirements for Iowa schools by Robin Opsahl, April 16, 2024. The Iowa Senate passed a bill Tuesday requiring Iowa schools to adopt new social studies and civics education standards to include a more focused coverage of events and subjects in U.S. history. House File 2545 passed on a 33-14 vote and was sent to the Senate. It calls for the Iowa Department of Education Director to conduct a review of Iowa school curriculum, education standards, and high school graduation rates, and give recommendations to the Governor and General Assembly by July 1, 2025. The bill still includes this goal, but was amended on the floor to include another subject, history and social studies education. Some of the language in the amendment came from House File 2330, a bill passed by the Iowa House in February, but not taken up by the Senate. The original House bill would have mandated that history curriculum included subjects like the, quote, history and meaning of the United States flag and national anthem, end quote, quote, exemplary figures in Western civilization, the United States and the state of Iowa, end quote, including Benjamin Franklin, Frederick Douglass, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, as well as documents like the Declaration of Independence and Articles of Confederation. The Senate amendment includes similar provisions, requiring that, quote, exemplary figures and important events, end quote, from Western civilization, U.S. and Iowa history are covered, as well as the model of the U.S. state and federal government, quote, in comparison to alternative forms of government, and the crimes against humanity that have occurred under communist regimes since 1917. The bill directs the Iowa Board of Education to conduct a review and revision of the state's social studies standards to include these subjects for students in grades 1 through 12 in a relevant and age-appropriate manner. These standards would be adopted by December 31, 2025. Democrats in the Senate argued that the bill was overly prescriptive of schools. Senator Molly Donahue, Democrat Cedar Rapids, said the legislature has never put curriculum requirements in code and that, quote, it is not the job of the legislature to prescribe the curriculum, end quote. Donahue said the provisions in the legislation came from the Civics Alliance, a conservative education advocacy organization, and does not include needed input from Iowa educators, parents, and school boards. She said the bill, quote, dumbs down history, end quote, for a political purpose and would hurt Iowa students' education in history, pointing to the mandate to cover documents like the Emancipation Proclamation, but not requiring discussion of issues like slavery and Jim Crow laws. Quote, what we do here at the Capitol matters to our constituency, Donahue said, and the bills that we put forth in education need to build on education, build it up, and provide the best opportunities for our students, not tear down the process and not tie the hands of experts to teach students will help them to be able to compete globally in their futures, as well as to understand the world better. Senator Herman Kornbach, Democrat Ames, offered an amendment that would have changed references to, quote, Western civilization, end quote, to, quote, world civilization, end quote, both to reflect the importance of non-American and European history and to reflect the history of people from diverse backgrounds in Iowa. The amendment failed. Senator Sandy Salmon, Republican, Janesville, said Democrats were presenting an overly negative characterization of Western civilization. The language does not prohibit schools from teaching about non-Western civilizations, she said, but is intended to, quote, focus our youth on who we are, end quote. Quote, we're Americans, Salmon said. We were born in Western civilization. That's our heritage. We have to understand that, and it's really important we do, because that heritage has produced the freest, strongest, most prosperous nation, civilization in the world, ellipses. Not that they don't. shouldn't be understanding other civilizations in the world, but they better understand what our heritage is, where we come from, so that they will be able to understand where we need to go. Quernbach responded to Salmon, saying that while Western civilization has its own strength and accomplishments, there has also been a history of mistakes and tragedies in U.S. and European history, including slavery and the Holocaust. He said the language in the bill focuses on white Americans and Europeans instead of reflecting the diversity of backgrounds in both the U.S. and Iowa. Senator Jeff Taylor, Republican Sioux Center, called Democrats' criticisms, quote, grossly unfair, end quote. He said the focus on Western civilization is important because it is the foundational context of both American history and current culture, from its form of governance to the use of the English language. He said he agrees that America is a, quote, nation of immigrants, end quote, and made up of people from across the world. Quote, part of what we have, because we are a melting pot that, ellipses, involves assimilation, is that those immigrants come to the United States. They bring new things to our land, their cultures, their languages, the words that they use. It all gets added to this great experience of being an American. And that's wonderful, Taylor said. But also, they blend in and they start to appreciate not only what they as newcomers bring to our land, but what the founding fathers brought to our land. The bill goes back to the House for consideration. Government and politics. Legislature approves ban on local guaranteed income programs. By Robin Opsahl, April 16, 2024. Iowa lawmakers have sent to Governor Kim Reynolds a bill banning local governments from implementing guaranteed income programs. The legislation, House File 2319, would largely impact the Uplift program in central Iowa that provides 110 people with a supplemental income of $500 per month with no work requirements or restrictions on how the money can be spent. The pilot program, launched by the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, with support from the Center for Guaranteed Income Research at the University of Pennsylvania in 2023, seeks to evaluate how guaranteed income programs can impact participants' health, well-being, and financial security. In Iowa, the program is working with adults living in Polk, Dallas, and Warren counties with household incomes at or below 60% of the area median income and who have at least one dependent. The program is receiving funds from the cities of Des Moines, Urbandale, and Windsor Heights, and Polk County, as well as private partners such as the Mid-Iowa Health and Wells Fargo Foundations. If signed into law, the legislation would ban local governments from implementing similar programs, allowing the state attorney's general office to send cease and desist letters to localities trying to make payments to individuals through a guaranteed income program. It also sets January 1, 2025, end date for current programs, meaning Uplift would not be able to reach its scheduled conclusion in May 2025. Democrats argued the bill, passed 35-13, prevents local governments from experimenting with the best methods to address poverty in their own communities. Senator Janice Wiener, Democrat Iowa City, said the issue is one of local control. While local government funding has been used in part for the program, no state funding has been put toward Uplift or any other guaranteed basic income program. Quote, this is the province of local government to experiment, to see what works, to run pilot programs, Wiener said. If it doesn't work, if people don't like them, they won't be elected the next time. It's the place for these sorts of experiments. Please do not preempt local government. Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat Des Moines, said the program's payments largely go to women and children, many of them single mothers, who need the most support. While the Republican-led legislature has not taken any action to support Iowans in the most need, he said, local governments are trying to help families in their communities. Not only do we have to do the best we can in the community that we live in, we have to fight off people like you who want to come in to disrupt what we're trying to do as a local government, Bisignano said. Bisignano also criticized Republicans for supporting government-funded payments like farming subsidies while opposing basic income programs. Quote, whether you call it a subsidy or, when you don't like it, a handout, what's the difference, Bisignano said. The bill's floor manager, Senator Scott Webster, Republican Bettendorf, said that in the Senate, quote, we've done a lot of things in this particular chamber to help poverty, end quote. and argued that other guaranteed income programs in the U.S. and abroad have shown that these supplemental payment programs do not help people escape poverty. Webster pointed to pilot programs in Canada and Finland that ended, which he said was because the initiatives were, quote, driving people away from work, end quote. Quote, so the studies have already been done, Webster said. Why do we need more studies? Why do we need to spend taxpayer dollars? It doesn't make a lot of sense, end quote. Webster attributed inflation, rising cost of living, and other factors that keep struggling families from escaping poverty to President Joe Biden, and said guaranteed basic income programs are an attempt to use taxpayer dollars to offset the problems caused by Democrat-supported economic policies. Quote, guess who's left to always hold the bag, Webster said. The middle class and those who work hard every day. Now we need a program to help pay for that disaster? Iowa taxpayers, people who are working hard to make their lives better and their families, should not be on the hook for the Biden administration's consequences of the policies. You are listening to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for April 19th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with this week's stories. Civil Rights and Immigration, Government and Politics. Iowa House votes to turn Iowa Civil Rights Commission into advisory panel. By Kathy Obradovich, April 16, 2024. The Iowa House voted Tuesday to diminish the role and authority of the Iowa Civil Rights Commission and combine individual commissions on the status of underrepresented populations into a single board. The legislation would turn the commission, created in 1965, into an advisory panel. Commission powers, such as the ability to investigate and address complaints on issues such as workplace violations of the Civil Rights Act, would instead go to the Iowa Office of Civil Rights and the Civil Rights Commission director. Quote, so really, by doing this, you'll be restricting, you'll be taking power and voice away from the people, those that have been discriminated against, groups that have been historically disenfranchised, Representative Ross Wilburn, Democrat Ames, said of the changes. Representative Jane Bloomingdale, Republican Northwood, the bill's floor manager, said she believed the commission would continue to, quote, hear cases and make decisions as they do right now, end quote. But Wilburn and other Democrats said the bill removes that authority and there's nothing in the language that indicates current practice would continue. The bill would also do away with panels such as the Commissions on Latino Affairs, Native American Affairs, the Commissions on the Status of Women, African Americans, Asian and Pacific Islanders, Persons with Disabilities, and Women. One person representing each group would be appointed to a consolidated human rights board. Representative Jerome Amos, Jr., Democrat Waterloo, offered an amendment to reverse those changes, saying the proposal, quote, make the hair stand up on my neck, end quote. He said the change is, quote, going to water down the voices of individuals that live in the state. Originally, you had a commission or a board that actually was made up of those different ethnic groups, and they actually had a voice, a collective voice. But what this is going to do is going to take away that voice, he said. Bloomingdale argued that members of the Combined Human Rights Board, quote, have a greater voice with representation on that board, ellipses, and they possibly learn from each other. She said she believes the existing commissions could continue to serve as advisory panels to the Human Rights Board. The measures were part of a sprawling bill that would eliminate 74 of Iowa's 256 boards and commissions and merge 9 current boards into 3 new bodies. 2 new boards would also be created. 10 boards would have their membership reduced. A summary of the changes is online. Bloomingdale emphasized that the board includes a panel that will review the performance of 25% of the boards and commissions every year and can recommend that panels be restored if needed. The Iowa House voted 54-42 on Senate File 2385 and will return it to the Senate for consideration of one amendment. The bill, as originally approved by the House, makes relatively modest changes to the legislation originally proposed by Governor Kim Reynolds, based on the recommendations of a task force created by last year's massive government reorganization legislation. Reynolds originally proposed to eliminate 111 boards or commissions. The House initially approved a bill that would have cut or merged only 49 panels, fewer than half of those proposed for change. However, after what Bloomingdale described as, quote, countless, end quote, meetings involving House and Senate leadership and the governor, the Senate's version of the bill largely prevailed. 8 Republicans joined Democrats in voting against the bill. Representatives Zach Deacon of Granville, Charlie Thomas of Charles City, Stephen Bradley of Cascade, Mark Cisneros of Muscatine, Brad Sherman of Williamsburg, Eddie Andrews of Johnston, Megan Jones of Sioux Rapids, and Thomas Gennery of Lamar's. Thompson was the only Republican to speak against the bill. He said, while it had some good points, quote, I'm disappointed in the bill because I have a philosophical disagreement with the approach of the bill to government. I think government is better when lots of people are participating in it. So reducing the number of people involved in boards and commissions, it seems to me, especially when they're voluntary, seems to be antithetical to getting lots of voices in government. Healthcare. Capital clicks. Trial date set for Lee County paramedic charged with sexual abuse. By Clark Kaufman, April 17, 2024. An Iowa paramedic criminally charged with sexually abusing a 10-year-old child is expected to stand trial on May 7th. Daniel Janish, 38, of Donaldson, is charged with felony incest and second-degree sexual abuse. Police allege that the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services was investigating a case last August when the agency discovered Janish had, quote, told several persons about an incident involving a minor child, end quote. The 10-year-old victim was then interviewed, and according to police, she alleged Janish placed her on a bed and began kissing her while placing his hands down her pants and rubbing her genitalia for a few minutes. Police also allege Janish, quote, admitted to coworkers that the incident happened, end quote. At the time, Janish worked for the Lee County Ambulance Service. Janish has pleaded not guilty to the charges. The 8th Judicial District Department of Correctional Services has recommended that Janish not be released from custody prior to trial. The department's recommendation to the court indicates Janish worked for Lee County Emergency Medical Services for 10 years prior to being fired in the wake of his arrest. In October 2023, the Bureau of Emergency Medical and Trauma Services issued an emergency order suspending Janish's paramedic license on the grounds that he posed, quote, an imminent danger to the public health, safety, and welfare, end quote. After several continuances, a jury trial in the criminal case is now scheduled for May 7th. Earlier this year, another Lee County EMT was issued a warning by the state for failing to administer CPR to a patient who subsequently died. Lee County EMS operates out of 3 stations located in Donaldson, Fort Madison, and Keokuk, and responds to roughly 5,900 emergency calls per year. Ag and environment. 2 veterinarians, hundreds of miles apart, solved a cow sickness whodunit. It took weeks for 2 Iowa State grads to discover bird flu was infecting dairy cattle in Texas. By Jared Strong, April 17, 2024. It appeared to be a problem with the food. In February, dairy cattle in multiple herds in northern Texas were suddenly producing less milk, and what they gave was abnormal and thick. And the typically voracious eaters had seemingly lost their appetites. For weeks in March, veterinarian Dr. Barb Peterson sought an answer. She talked to dairy owners and exchanged notes with fellow vets in the panhandle of Texas. She submitted numerous samples to labs that tested for more than 200 potential causes. Quote, any fluid you can collect from a live animal, I collected it, said Peterson, who was raised on a dairy farm near Davenport, Iowa. As did many others, there were so many of us at the same time texting each other and trying to figure this out. She started messaging Dr. Drew Magstadt, who she had studied alongside at Iowa State University years before. He now works at the ISU Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, a preeminent national animal testing lab in Ames, and researches infectious disease in cattle. When the voluminous amount of testing in Texas failed to find any clues, Magstadt and Peterson concluded that a likely cause was ill-made food. Quote, the affected cattle were very high-producing dairy cows, and they were on a race car ration, Magstadt said. If you mess with that a little bit, it can cause problems. Peterson agreed to send Magstadt some samples of the feed and animals for testing. But then, the cats started dying. Barn cats are common on farms. They kill rodents, provide companionship, and need little help to survive. Some dairy farmers also feed them milk from their cows, and sick cows can shed viruses in their milk. Quote, a colleague of mine, he told me, so quote, you know what's strange? I went to one of my dairies last week, and all their cats were missing. I couldn't figure it out. The cats usually come back to my vet truck. End subquote, Peterson recalled. And then someone called me and said half of his cats had passed away without warning. And so then all the alarm bells starting going off in your head, end quote. The cats had died from swollen brains, a potential result of influenza. They didn't have rabies. Outbreaks of highly pathogenic avian influenza have plagued poultry producers in the United States since early 2022 and have led to the culling of more than 90 million domestic birds in backyard and commercial flocks. It is often transmitted by wild migrating birds. The virus had never been known to infect cattle in the country, and so the potential for it to have sickened the Texas cattle seemed unlikely, Magstadt thought. It could be a, quote, zebra, end quote, Peterson said, which in medical parlance can refer to a surprising exotic diagnosis. Yet Magstadt immediately tested Peterson's milk samples for influenza A, which most commonly infects birds, before investigating the feed. He thought the testing would merely rule out bird flu as a potential cause, but instead it confirmed it. Quote, I was incredibly surprised, Magstadt said. Further testing and retesting over several days confirmed that the virus is the type that has been driving the poultry outbreaks, with an official confirmation on March 25th. The initial affected herds were in northern Texas and southwest Kansas, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Since then, infected cattle have been discovered in far-flung states, including South Dakota, often the result of infected cattle being transported to new herds. So far, bird flu has been detected in 28 dairy cattle herds in 8 states, the USDA said. There is evidence that the virus has transmitted cow to cow, an alarming revelation that heightens its threat. One person who worked closely with infected cattle also contracted the illness. Quote, There's plenty of times that we get called in to these types of situations, and sometimes we strike out, Maxat said. The times that we do find something, it's very rewarding. Ellipses. Everybody was just stumbling around the dark, and it's great to be involved in turning on the light. The Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory in Ames is the largest tester of livestock disease in the country. It conducted about 1.6 million tests last year. The first construction phase for its new facility recently finished, and the second part is expected to be complete in 2026 at a total cost of more than $140 million. Government and politics. House committee advances bill to raise pay for lawmakers, statewide elected officials. By Robin Opsahl, April 17, 2024. A panel of House lawmakers approved legislation Wednesday that would increase pay for legislators and statewide elected officials by $10,000. The House Appropriations Committee passed House Study Bill 750 on a 17-8 vote. The bill, raising salaries for legislators and statewide elected officials, advanced quickly in the expected final days of session. The measure was introduced Tuesday, and a subcommittee unanimously approved it the same day. Lawmakers quickly moved on the bill during the committee meeting, with Representative Adam Zabner, Democrat, Iowa City, saying that it is, quote, a good bill. It's good for Iowa, end quote. During the subcommittee meeting on the legislation, lawmakers spoke more in depth about the need for a pay increase. Representative Steve Holt, Republican Denison, said no one likes to talk about giving themselves a pay raise, but that legislators needed to face the, quote, reality, end quote, that action must be taken to ensure that all Iowans are able to realistically consider serving in office. Quote, Do we want our legislature made up of a bunch of rich folks and retired folks? Holt asked. Because that'll be the only ones that can afford to serve up here. Or do we want the representation of the legislature to be based upon the people of Iowa? End quote. The bill would increase the pay for Iowa representatives and senators to $35,000 a year, as well as raising the pay for lawmakers in leadership positions, including House Speaker, Senate President, and each chamber's majority and minority leaders to $47,500. The House Speaker pro tempore and Senate President pro tempore would earn a salary of $37,000. The bill would also grant a $10,000 raise to statewide elected officials, putting Governor Kim Reynolds' salary at $140,000 and Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd at $133,669. Other elected officials, including Iowa's Secretary of State, State Auditor, Treasurer, and Secretary of Agriculture, would all have their salaries increased to $133,202 annually. These increases would go into effect starting the 2025 legislative session. Beginning in 2026, the bill would apply a cost of living adjustment each year to legislators' pay equal to the average adjustments negotiated by public collective bargaining units representing workers like police officers and government employees. Current salaries, legislators make $25,000 annually, have been brought up in retirement speeches as lawmakers seek to end the session. Representative Phil Thompson, Republican Boone, said during his retirement speech early in April that while he enjoyed serving as a legislator, he could not afford to continue to serve as he and his wife are expecting their first child, Radio Iowa reported. Quote, as rewarding as this work is, it really isn't cut out for working-age families, Thompson, 33, said. You guys should really fix that if you want a representative government, end quote. The Iowa legislature generally meets 4 months out of the year, and many lawmakers maintain other employment. Representative Joel Fry, Republican Osceola, said Tuesday, quote, we'll see where we go, end quote, with this bill this year, as it has not been agreed upon with the Senate Republicans or the governor. He also echoed others' comments about why the pay increase is needed. Quote, I think it's a very modest increase, actually, what we're looking at here on this bill, and also believe that if we want the representation of people across Iowa to serve in this role, that we have to look into that we're paying those folks to be here, Fry said. Ag and Environment, Government and Politics, Commentary. A rushed farm bill is a bad one. This Congress already has failed. Let the next Congress take it up. By Art Cullen, April 19, 2024. From the Iowa Writers Collaborative. A five-year farm bill was supposed to have been approved last year, but was held up in the House over disagreements on food stamps, conservation, crop insurance, and funding. House Agriculture Committee Chair Glenn Thompson, Republican Pennsylvania, announced last week that he will find a way to push a farm bill out before Memorial Day in order to get President Biden to sign a new farm bill by the end of the year. Don't bet the farm on it. Senator Chuck Grassley said he is pessimistic, and so is Senator Joni Ernst, both Republican Ag Committee members. Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican Hall, is optimistic. Quote, so, there's going to be a lot of talk, especially when it comes to SNAP and stuff like that, but I fully believe that we will get it out of the House, and then it's just a matter of what Senator Chuck Schumer and Senator Debbie Stabenow is going to do in the Senate when it comes their way, Feenstra told Brownfield News. If a new farm bill can't pass this year, it is expected that another one-year extension will be passed. Grassley said farmers would receive protection, but not adequate protection. Getting beyond an extension of the same old would be up to a new Congress, and as of now, it is anybody's guess who will be in charge. It's not as if the existing hang-ups are going anywhere. Fights over food stamps in the House stalled the last farm bill by 2 years. House Speaker Mike Johnson walks on eggshells in his caucus room as he is accused of caving in to Democrats on spending. The same sticking points will be as sticky in 2025. It's a huge piece of legislation with terribly complicated politics. You have regional interests from the South and Midwest battling over commodity payments. You have disagreements between commodity and livestock interests. Then you throw in cultural wedge issues like food stamps, SNAP benefits, and it all becomes a mishmash. What used to be a fairly bipartisan process in the past decade has devolved into a food fight like everything else in Washington. Because so few know or care about the work of the agriculture committees, their work is controlled by the interest groups that fund our politics. If food is important, the farm bill should be. Our food security and agricultural resiliency are imperiled by a warming climate. A farm bill with conservation at its core could serve farmers and the environment better. The Farm Bill, as it is and has been over the past 40 years, has resulted in more consolidation, accelerated rural depopulation, more surface water pollution in Iowa, and fewer farmers. It also has stunted funding for research into livestock disease as pandemics build and bird flu jumps to humans. Putting a new label on a defective product does not make it better. But it might make some politicians look better if they can say they actually got some lipstick applied to the pig. Crop insurance remains intact, as does a safety net for commodity markets. Food stamps, too. As Grassley said, the protections are in place. So instead of jamming through an even worse farm bill than we already have, which is likely in this election year, we may all be better off if we take our time and do it right. Ernst should be the number three Republican in the Senate following the election and the top woman in the caucus. She could establish herself as a national leader by stating unequivocally that nutrition programs are the most effective way to fight poverty, which makes all of America stronger. Democrats and Republicans used to join hands over it. Hubert Humphrey and Bob Dole, Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley. Someone needs to be a voice of reason. The ethanol industry, for example, is openly acknowledging that the future for corn growers depends on capturing tax credits for carbon dioxide pipeline. That's not a great position for Iowa farmers to be in, but that is where the current farm bill puts us. We could write a new piece of legislation that enhances soil and water health while directly paying farmers for stewardship. We can make conservation programs a lot more flexible. We can help farmers diversify their revenue streams while cleaning up the Raccoon River, which did not have a nitrate problem before farm programs encouraged planting fence row to fence row. And it could cost less if we cut corporations off the teat, which would have a lot of appeal in Iowa. That is not likely to happen by Memorial Day. More of the same is. Art Cullen is editor of the Storm Lake Times Pilot, where this column first appeared, as well as Art Cullen's notebook on Substack. It is republished here as part of the Iowa Writers Collaborative. Justice, public information, commentary. The media should shut up about the Trump jurors. By David Busiek, April 17th, 2024. From the Iowa Writers Collaborative. I was astounded Tuesday evening when I turned on CNN and saw anchors and analysts revealing details about the seven jurors picked so far in the first criminal trial of Donald Trump. There weren't any names or faces revealed, but many of the facts were. At the risk of compounding the error by citing one example to make the point here, here's how CNN described a juror. Quote, "The third seated juror is a corporate lawyer. He's originally from Oregon. He gets his news from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Google. He's a younger man who's never been married and doesn't have kids," end quote. How long is it going to take an internet sleuth to figure out who this guy is, if it hasn't already happened by the time this column is published? Then a whole host of problems will ensue. Trump's anonymous internet trolls will start digging into the juror's background to find any whiff of controversy that might be there. He will be threatened with all manner of bodily harm. There might be offers of vast riches if he will vote one way or another. Stories about him will be made up. People will contact him under false pretenses, trying to trap him or trip him up. Look no further than Georgia election workers Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, who were reportedly approached by publicists for Kanye West, offering to help, but really to pressure them to change their story, according to Reuters. Both women had to leave their homes and move into a safe house because of the vile, racist threats made against them. The corporate lawyer, originally from Oregon, is just one example. Revealing details about the other jurors were reported that, in my view, give way too much information. Iowa rules protect jurors. Jury selection is supposed to be sacrosanct. Here in Iowa, where we have one of the most open court systems in the country for electronic media coverage of trials, there are rules that protect jurors. Reporters can be present, but cameras and microphones are not allowed in the courtroom during jury selection. Jurors' names are never reported unless they choose to reveal their names after the trial. During the trial, jurors are never shown on camera, never. When they file in and out of the courtroom, the camera operator is instructed to point the camera at the floor or away from the jury box. All of this is done to protect the jurors who have been summoned to perform their civic duty. They haven't chosen to be there. The law says they must be there. They and their families need to be protected, particularly from criminal defendants who are dangerous. Our criminal justice system is corrupted if jurors vote to acquit someone because they fear for their lives if they vote guilty. What do we know? I have no issues with general descriptions of the jury panel as a whole. For instance, it's made up of 8 women and 4 men, or the racial makeup, if that's relevant to the case. But specific details about individual jurors should be off limits. This may be the only Trump case that goes to trial before the election. As a country, we can't afford for it to run off the rails. Do we Americans need to know these details about individual jurors? At this point, we don't. If after the trial they wish to reveal details about their personal lives to help us understand why they arrived at the verdict, that is their choice. Until then, I wish the news media would show some restraint, something we're not very good at. This column was first published by Dave Busiak on Media and is reprinted here through the Iowa Writers Collaborative. Dave Busiak spent 43 years working in Iowa radio and television newsrooms as a reporter, anchor, and the last 30 years as news director of KCCI-TV, the CBS affiliate in Des Moines. He was inducted into the Iowa Broadcasters Hall of Fame in 2018 and is a recipient of the Iowa Broadcast News Association's Jack Shelley Award. He is a graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism. He retired at the end of 2018. He is a member of the Iowa Writers Collaborative, and his blog, Dave Busiak on Media, appears on Substack. And that does it for today's reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for April 19th, 2024. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.